Just to explain about the change in topic, Rabbi Kelman suggested to me that we have a new name for the series in Elul. We will continue, at least in the first sessions in Elul, in with the texts from Parshat Mishpatim that deal with strangers, widows, and orphans. So for those of you who are looking for continuity, there will be some continuity. And for the people who wish to join just for Elul, they will have a congruent set of texts that deal with the problems of relating to strangers, widows, and orphans. And the discussion about that begins in the Torah in Parshat Mishpatim. We didn't quite get that far, and we won't quite get that far before Elul, but we will get close. In the meantime, we are still dealing with the question of an eye for an eye, and we will continue with that today. Let me get the right view here. So we spent the last session 2 weeks ago talking about an eye for an eye, but there's more to say about it, and we will continue on that today. Just to remind ourselves where this appears in the text, after the part of the text that talks about damage to a pregnant woman or damage to her fetus, it says, V'machon yeh v'natata nefesh tachat nefesh,
ayin tachat ayin, shein tachat shein. If other damages
ensues, the penalty shall be life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, bruise for bruise. And we saw, I'm sure this was not news for anybody here, that the Jewish tradition does not actually take this literally. While for the most part, traditional Jewish commentaries do not like seeing phrases as metaphorical or as allegorical. This is one of the exceptions in the history of Jewish Christian polemics. The Christians always accused the Jews of taking the Bible overly literally and not understanding that texts had a meaning beyond the literal meaning of the text. But here is an example where the Jewish tradition understood this as, even though it says an eye for an eye, certainly it doesn't mean an eye for an eye. Rambam discusses the issue in his Mishneh Torah, and he also discusses the issue in his Guide of the Perplexed. And Rambam's scholars are, well, I guess I could say, they're a little bit perplexed about the difference between the way that Rambam dealt with this issue in the Mishneh Torah. The Mishneh Torah is Rambam's law code, which almost never gets into biblical interpretation. It's just, you know, to tell you what the law is.
Rambam says that, you know, I'm not going to give you the
reason for any of the laws. I'm not going to provide footnotes for any laws. You can go and study the Talmud if you want to see where things came from, but I'm just going to tell you what the law is. And almost throughout the book, that's what he does. He doesn't get into, like, the background behind it, but when he gets to the laws of Chovel Umazik, the laws of causing physical damage to another human being, Rambam does something that he doesn't normally do. He gives you like this exegetical argument, his interpretive argument, why it is that we don't take this literally. So here's what he says. In the first four halachot, in this section of his law code, he's dealing with what could really just be called biblical interpretation. Ayin tachat ayin nidya shmua lamdu shezesh shenemar tachat l'shalim mamon hu. An eye for an eye, tachat
an eye from the
oral Torah. We know that the word tachat implies a monetary penalty. He wasn't the first to say this, and he was not the last to say this. And I mentioned 2 weeks ago, I mentioned the book written by Benno Jacob on the subject, and the discussion of the word tzachat was crucial to the argument that Benno Jacob made for taking this text as not meaning literally an eye for an eye. So that's his first halacha, his first paragraph discussing this.
Then he tries another argument.
When the Torah says, just as he caused a blemish in another, so shall it be done to him. It does not mean to injure him the same way he injured another. And here he presents an interesting argument. We've seen this argument before. Other commentators have said this. We saw this 2 weeks ago. It says, you may not take a ransom for a murderer. If a murderer comes along and wants to buy off
the penalty by paying a fine to the court,
or perhaps to the family of the deceased, which is what happened generally in antiquity. The Torah says you're not allowed to take a monetary fine to let somebody off the hook if he is a rotzeach. And Rambam says, the rotzeach yodad hu she'en bo koter, aval lechisron evarim ol lechabalot ish lo koter. This means the murderers cannot escape with a ransom, but there is a ransom for injuries and for physical damage. As I said, we saw this argument before, but the next argument that he's going to give, we didn't see it before. But how do we know that when it says about the loss of limbs, an eye for an eye, it means monetary payments? You know, he already said in the first paragraph, well, the word tachat teaches us this. He's trying every trick up his sleeve to try to prove that this could not literally mean
an eye for an eye.
And here's the argument that we haven't seen before that Rambam formulates. Because it also says, chabura, tachat
chabura,
a wound for a wound. And yet, the verse explicitly says, if one strikes the other with stone or fist, which
means that you wound
the person, he must pay for his
idleness and his cure. We saw that a few weeks ago, a month ago or so. We saw that it
says that if you cause a physical injury to somebody else and they don't die,
so the context of deciding when the person dies later, was it because of a physical injury?
So once we determine that the person did not die, then the only penalty is shitoyitin v'rapo yirapik. You pay for the loss of time that the person was unable to go to work, and you pay the doctor bills for this person.
Halamata shetachat shenemar b'chabura tashlumim, v'hu hadin
letachat ha'amur ba'ayin
u'bisha'ar evarim. So, just on
the assumption that
Exodus 21 does not contradict itself, that when it said a few
verses ago that for wounding somebody, the penalty is a monetary penalty, and here it says chabura, tachat chabura, which sounds like, you know, wound for wound. He says, no, it just means that there is an appropriate penalty depending on what the wound was. And since chabura, tachat chabura means a penalty that is a monetary penalty, then ayin tachat ayin also means a penalty that is a monetary penalty. I hope you followed this argument, because we're going to get back to this argument in a few minutes. So he's saying, it's on the assumption that Exodus chapter 21 is consistent, and once
Exodus chapter 21
said that if you wound somebody, there are monetary payments to make. And then it says chabura tachat chabura, wound for wound. So wound for wound must mean monetary payment. And if chabura tachat chabura means monetary payment, then ayin tachat ayin means monetary payment. An interesting argument. And then after these three paragraphs, in the fourth paragraph, Rambam offers yet another argument for this. And I must say, I know some of you are going to think that maybe I get a percentage from suggesting to you that you go and look at the website called alachorah.org, but it's a free website and you use it and nobody gets paid for using it. And so nobody gets any commission for sending anybody there. When I was preparing this class and I was looking at the Rambam here in the standard text, I have to say that the Hebrew in the standard text did not make sense to me.
And so I went to
alachorah.org and I saw the
text of the Rambam
that Dr. Hillel Novetzky put onto his website with many footnotes talking about the manuscripts that he used in order to determine that this is the correct text of the Rambam. There's only two letters different in this text that I gave you here than what you find in the standard text that bothered me. Those two letters bothered me until I looked up. Anyways, the afal pi shedvarim elu nirim meinyan haTorah shebichtav kulan meforashim hein miti Moshe Rabbeinu mehar Sinai. I've just given you textual arguments from within the written Torah, trying to prove to you that the written Torah has to be interpreted in such a way that ayin tachat ayin means money.
But if that's not good enough for you, then you should also know that
this is part of the oral Torah, that when Moshe was on Har Sinai, God turned to him when he gave him the Torah and said to him, you see where it says ayin tachat ayin here? It means it means money. And Moshe said, okay. And then he came down the mountain and he told everybody, he gave everybody the Torah, and the Torah said, ayin tachat ayin. And he said,
ayin tachat ayin actually means money. So even though
I have proved it to you in the previous three paragraphs that a careful reading of the written Torah text brings us to this conclusion. But beyond that, we also, beyond that, we also know
about this from the oral tradition which Moshe received on Har Sinai.
Every once in a while,
a commentator
comes along and says, you know, the interpretation here, you might not like this interpretation, but this is the interpretation that Moshe received on Har Sinai when he received the Torah. Now, of course, the result of a claim like that is cutting off debate, because then, you know, there's nothing left to do in biblical interpretation. If the authentic interpretation of the text was provided to Moshe at Har Sinai, so Rambam doesn't try this maneuver very often, but he uses it here. He says, nothing else is possible for understanding this text, because this is what Moshe heard when he was on Mount Sinai. And here we have a difference between what you find in the standard text and what you find in the excellent text that was assembled by Dr. Novetzky at alatorah.org. Most of the texts read, V'chulam halacha leMoshe hein biyadeinu. And this is the phrase halacha leMoshe is short for halacha leMoshe miSinai. And then he'd just be repeating what he said in the previous line. In the previous line, he says these were all made explicit by Moses at Mount Sinai, because he learned that from God. And they all have the status of actually the website, halatorah.org, you see that the word is not le Moshe, but le Maaseh. Kulan halacha le Maaseh ein v'yadeinu. Halacha le Maaseh means practical halacha. In other words, this isn't just some kind of theoretical study in the Beit Midrash for the sake of study, for the sake of study. This is the way in which halacha is supposed to be practiced, that when you find in the Talmud this discussion, it's a discussion that is halacha l'maaseh. It's a halacha that is supposed to be followed. And then he adds yet another argument. Furthermore, we saw our ancestors adjudicating this way in every court, that of Joshua, that of Samuel, and each and every Beit Din from the days of Moses to today. So he cites history. That's his last proof here. So we have, just to review the four paragraphs here of Rambam's argument. He begins with the word tachad. Then he offers the argument from ransoms are only forbidden if for murderers or other people, monetary penalties are just fine. And then he says, well, if it says that a blemish, that after a blemish, after wounding somebody, you have to give them a monetary payment, that teaches us that chabura, tachat chabura, must mean monetary payment. And then all of these words, like ayin
tachat ayin, shein tachat shein, must also mean monetary payment.
And then the calling upon tradition, this is what Moshe learned, and this is what Moshe taught us. And then calling upon history, that history shows us, I'm not sure how Rambam knows this, but anyways, Rambam says, this is what we saw in every Beit Din from the time of Joshua, right after the death of Moshe. This has always been the way that Batei Din have adjudicated cases of damage. Okay, this is what Rambam writes in the Mishneh Torah. And then we look to see what he wrote in his great philosophical work, The Guide of the Perplexed. Now, scholars love to deal with issues of the contradictions between what Rambam writes in his halachic work and what he writes in his philosophic work. There aren't, you know, there isn't an infinite list of contradictions, but there are a few times when Rambam says different things. We'll say something about it, but first of all, let's just see what he says in the Guide of the Perplexed, and then we'll talk a little bit about what we like, the significance of how to deal with this contradiction. Okay. Here's Rambam, the Guide of the Perplexed, part 3, chapter 41. The punishment of one who sins against his neighbor consists in the general rule that there shall be done unto him exactly as he has done. If he injured anyone personally, he must suffer personally. If he damaged the property of his neighbor, he shall be punished by loss of property. So if there's an injury that occurs to a human being, then the punishment will be on you, you, the perpetrator, on your body,
if you
damage property, then you will lose property.
Damage property or chattels, you end up losing money.
Or you end up losing your property or your chattels. And that,
so that's the principle of justice in the Torah. And this isn't
really on our topic here, but I thought that
this is such an interesting comment that Rambam
made here in the Guide of the Perplexed that we would read it before we go on to the continuation, which is really on topic. Even if the murdered person continued to live after the attack for an hour or for days and was able to speak and possess complete consciousness, and if he himself said, pardon my murderer, I have pardoned and forgiven him, he must not be obeyed. We must take life for life and estimate equally the life of a child
and that of a
grown-up person, of a slave and of a free man, of a wise man and of a fool. for there is no greater sin than this. Because of the severity of murder, there's no forgiving it. And there's a nice democratic statement here that every human being is equal, child, grown up, slave, free man, wise person, foolish person, doesn't matter. And you can't forgive your murderer. And he finds a way where it is theoretically possible that somebody is dying and is compos mentis and is able to say to us, to the court, I don't want this person punished for the loss of my life. Rambam says we don't listen to the person. Okay, now Rambam gets back to damages that aren't murder, and he writes, he who mutilated a limb of his neighbor must himself lose a limb. As he has caused a blemish in a man, so shall it be done to him again. Hello? Rambam is now in the Guide of the Perplexed, interpreting the text literally. After we just saw that long speech of his in four different paragraphs trying to argue against the idea that an eye for an eye literally, and Rambam realizes that the readers of the Guide of the Perplexed are going to know that that isn't halacha, and so he says here, you must not raise an objection from our practice of imposing a fine in such cases. I know,
we don't actually do this,
but the principle is, if you want to understand the principle is an eye for an eye. And why should I not be concerned about this objection from our practice of imposing a fine? He says, for we have proposed to ourselves to give here in this book, in the Guide of the Perplexed, the reasons for the precepts mentioned in the Torah, and not for that which is stated in the Talmud. The Guide of the Perplexed is about the Bible. It's not about the Talmud. Practically speaking, we observe the Judaism of the Talmud. And so you'll find in the Mishnah Torah, when I summarize the law, I summarize the Talmudic approach. But here I am summarizing what it says in the Torah. I have, however, an explanation for the interpretation given in the Talmud, but it will be communicated viva voce, in other words, in person, face to face.
I've got something to tell you about what it says in the Talmud, but I'm not going to write it here. I think I've mentioned before that the ruse of the Guide of the Perplexed is that Rambam, he writes in the introduction that he wrote this whole book for his student Yosef, because his student Yosef was perplexed. And so it is likely that here he is addressing Yosef and saying to Yosef, if you come to me, I'll explain to you something about that Talmudic passage, but I'm not going to write it down here in my book. But then, okay, all of this we might be able to explain away, sort of, until we get to the last sentence here. Injuries that cannot be reproduced exactly in another person are compensated for by payments. We will pay only damages of lost wages and medical expenses. That what it said in Parshat Mishpatim is the principle in the Torah is an eye for an eye. Why does it say if somebody causes a wound to another person that the only penalty is lost wages and medical expenses? Because when you bruise somebody or wound somebody, it's very difficult to reproduce that injury precisely. And so, in a situation that it's difficult to reproduce the injury, precisely there, the penalty is monetary. Just to remind people, three slides ago, we saw Rambam arguing from that text. That text proves that ayin tachat ayin could not be literal.
because it says here, if one strikes the other with stone or fist, he must pay for his idleness and for his cure. So we see that tachat, written about wounds, means money. So it also means money when it's applied to the loss of an eye or another organ. And now Rambam is arguing, well, the difference, the reason why there is this difference is when it cannot be, when the injury cannot easily be reproduced exactly in the other person, then there's a monetary penalty. And otherwise, the Torah is saying, the Torah should be understood as saying,
saying an eye for an eye, literally.
Okay, so what's going on here?
Why does the Rambam say one thing in the
in his law code and something else in the guide of the in the guide of perplexed? As I said, scholars love to deal with these kinds of issues, and particularly they love to deal with the issue of which one is the real Rambam. Is the real Rambam the one who wrote the Mishnah Torah, the law code, or is the real Rambam the one who wrote the Guide of the Perplexed? That is, you know, is Rambam really the philosopher that we see here in this text, in the Guide of the Perplexed? You know, setting aside what it said there in the Talmud, but when he wrote his law code, he wrote it with the Frumis in mind, and so he wrote it in such a way that the Frumis would find it more more meaningful. Or is the real Rambam the one who wrote the law code? And when he came here, he was writing to a very small audience of perplexed people who are perplexed about the contradiction between the Torah and the and philosophy. And so he's presenting arguments here that are not the real Rambam. So those are two possibilities, but the real Rambam is the Rambam of the law code, or that the real Rambam is the Rambam of the philosophy. Another possibility, of course, is that a number of years went by. Rambam started writing his law code when he was 32 years old. The process went on for a number of years, but he was in his 50s when he wrote the Guide of the Perplexed. And when I used to teach material like this in the old days when I was in my 50s, I used to tell my students, I don't agree with everything that I thought or that I wrote when I was 32 years old. But so, it just doesn't bother me that much to see that Rambam's saying one thing in his 30s and another thing in his 50s. That's yet another possibility. And of course, the final possibility is that he had some explanation, viva voce, that would resolve all of this for us. And we don't know what it is because we never met the Rambam. But somebody who did meet the Rambam and talk to the Rambam about Torah at length wrote about this, and that was his son, Rabbi Abraham, the son of Rambam, who wrote in his commentary on the Torah. Let me just tell you, Abraham, the son of Maimonides' commentary on the Torah, was written in Judeo-Arabic, just like the Guide of the Perplexed was written in Judeo-Arabic. Here's an acceptable translation here into English of the Judeo-Arabic of Rambam's Guide of the Perplexed. There is no translation into English of the Judeo-Arabic commentary written by Rambam's son Avraham, and we do have this old Hebrew translation. Somebody told me that somebody's working on a newer translation, and I'd love to see it because my Judeo-Arabic is extremely weak, and it wouldn't make any sense for me to look it up here and try to find out what it says in the Judeo-Arabic. And you'll see that it, I'd like to know what actually Rambam's son said here. My father and the guide hinted about this subject. He explained to me orally Rambam wrote in the Guide to the Perplexed that he has something to say about this. And Avraham is saying here, he told me what he had to say about it. So, this word hachra'a
sometimes means harmonization
in medieval Hebrew, but it could also mean a decision.
Hachria, when you have a
scale and you've got something on both sides of the scale, the question is, the phrase that we've talked about in the 13 ways of interpreting the Torah, that if you have
a contradiction,
then you look for another text that will come along, a contradiction between two texts, you look for a third text that will come along, the Yachriya Benehem. So
that could also be what he meant by Hachra'a here, or the Judeo
Arabic
might mean something else entirely.
But
Avram said, after I talked to the Abba about
this,
after I talked to my father about this, I felt a lot better about it.
But then he said,
I cannot write it since he had it.
Rambam said here,
I'm not gonna,
it will be communicated viva voce. So he communicated it to his son, and his son said, oh, wonderful explanation from Abba, but I can't tell you what that explanation is. So the speculation on this issue continues, and any of you who wish to speculate about what it is that Rambam actually thought
about this
issue, you are more than welcome to do so. Move on to one more surprising interpretation of the text, and that is Shadal Samuel David Luzzatto, Italy, first part of the 19th century, and a big fan of Pshat.
Here is what Luzzatto writes. From what is written, they do not accept a ransom for the life
of a murderer who is guilty of death, but he must be put to death. There is clear proof that the Torah permits the taking of monetary ransom in the case of other injuries that do not involve death. We saw that in Rambam. We saw that
2 weeks ago
in other commentators, that argument that actually... That's like what the Torah is saying, that you deserve to lose a limb if you destroy the limb of another human being, but we're going to allow you to ransom it, and it's only in a case of murder that we do not allow monetary ransom. Okay, so that Shadal said, he's just following in the tradition of the interpretation. But then on the next screen, he says something surprising. This is one of the decisions that the Torah left to the judges. For if indeed there would be a rich person who did not mind losing his money and who took pleasure in injuring others. never thought of this problem. And Shadal came along and said, well, what happens if you have an extremely wealthy person who gets his jollies from injuring other human beings? And for him, for this extremely wealthy person, paying a monetary penalty is, there's nothing to it. Okay, go ahead, ask me to pay a monetary penalty. That doesn't bother me. And so Shadal said that the Torah wrote here that an eye for an eye. So the judges would, if they ever encountered a situation like this, a rich person who thinks that he can injure any human being that he wants and just throw a few pesos towards the person whom he injured. If indeed there would be a rich person who did not mind losing his money and who took pleasure in injuring others, the judges would be able to impose the written penalty eye for eye. In the Roman laws, it is written, a Renaissance man, he lived after the Renaissance, but he read so widely and had such great knowledge of the literature of the world. And he quotes from a Roman law code, which, of course, the Roman law codes are a lot later than the Torah, but these Roman law codes are around the time of the Talmud. And there it is written. Si membrum, I'm reading it in the Latin for those of you who, like me, were forced to study Latin in high school. It's not such a difficult Latin here. C, member Rupert, nicum eo pocket, talio est. So the Roman law says, if he maimed a part of the body, unless he settles with the victim, there is to be retaliation. So, Shadal knows that in the Roman law codes, they said that there were these two possibilities. You can work out some kind of deal with the person, a monetary deal with the person whom you injured. And if you don't work out a deal like that, then there is the talio. Talio means the precise punishment. The people who understand eye for an eye literally outside of the Jewish tradition, because inside of the Jewish tradition, people don't understand it literally, but outside of the Jewish tradition, they refer to it as the law of the talion, lex talionis. The law that says that the penalty should be precisely equal to the crime. And remember that actually that's what Rambam began his discussion of this in the Guide to the Perplexed, said the punishment of someone who sins against his neighbor consists in the general rule that should be done to him exactly as he has done. This is like the law of the talion, as Rambam is phrasing it, that, you know, you kill somebody, you get killed. You knock somebody's eye out, they knock out your eye. It is what the Torah is saying. And then Shadal is saying the reason that this is there is because if the judges feel that the appropriate penalty isn't money, because money is nothing to the perpetrator here, or if the person is not willing to work out the situation with the victim, then the law of the talion comes in. But that's what the Romans said about situations of this nature. And there is a very good translation of Shadal's commentary on the Torah into English with some extremely helpful footnotes translated and footnoted by Daniel Klein. In the meantime, only the first three volumes of the Humash have come out, but I spoke to Daniel Klein not that long ago, and he told me that he's at work on Bamidbar, and he's hoping to complete the entire series. So here's the footnote that he wrote on this comment of Shadal. The law of Talion, lex talionis, is the principle that criminals should receive as punishment precisely those injuries and damages they inflicted upon their victims. And this was a principle in Roman law. Modern scholarship echoes Shadal's view, and then he quotes Daniel Klein, also reads widely and found this article about the history of law. The central claim of the new research on talionic system is that revenge coexisted with the option of compensation. Revenge was not phased out gradually, but was a central component of the whole idea of compensation. In other words, people who study the history of Roman law, this isn't somebody here, this Caius Duori is not somebody who's studying specifically Jewish law, but studying Roman law said that what people used to argue, scholars used to argue, that there was a period in Roman law when there was the law of the talion, that for injuries there would be the precise same thing would be done to somebody, to the perpetrator, and then it was changed to compensation. So the new historians claim that the two systems worked at the same time, and that's what Shadal is suggesting. You know, that's kind of his attempted marriage of the rabbinic understanding together with the biblical text, that the biblical text talks about talion, about precisely identical punishment, and rabbinic tradition talks about money. And so Shadal is arguing that maybe there was like a period in Jewish history where these two things function at the same time. Okay. Just to confuse things a little more, 2,000 years ago, Philo of Alexandria, writing in Alexandria in Egypt in Greek, trying to explain Jewish law to a Greek reading audience. You know, he was writing his books not for most scholars think that he was writing his books not for internal Jewish consumption, but for the people who were curious about Judaism there in Greek-speaking Egypt 2,000 years ago. Here's a summary here. Our law exhorts us to equality when it ordains that the penalties inflicted on offenders should correspond to their actions. If the offense was a bodily injury, the penalty being determined according to the limb, part, or sense affected. So it looks like
Philo is writing as if
Tallien is, this is his understanding. Philo did not know the rabbinic tradition. Philo did not know Hebrew very well. He was a very proud Jew, but he studied the Bible in the Septuagint, in the Greek in the Greek translation. He was an observant Jew. You know, we know about this phenomenon these days. Serious observant Jews who don't read Hebrew very well and who don't know the rabbinic traditions very well. So the rabbinic traditions are starting up, being written down or being passed down orally in the days of Philo 2,000 years ago. But he just says, this is what the Torah teaches us. And a few years after Philo of Alexandria, also writing in Greek, Josephus, writing in Antiquities of the Jews, writes, "Whoever maims another person shall undergo the like, being deprived of that same limb that he deprived the other of, unless indeed the maimed person be willing to accept money, for the law empowers victims to assess the damage that befell them and makes this concession." So this is a little more interesting because Josephus lived in Eretz Yisrael.
And he knew
what the Pharisees were teaching, what the rabbis
were teaching at the end of the first century. And
did he actually hear, and he probably knew Hebrew better than Philo knew Hebrew. He's writing in Greek. And so he's saying what Shaddai had suggested before, that maybe the two systems were functioning at the same time. Although it is possible, again, Josephus, while he lived here in Eretz Yisrael and he learned about Judaism here in Eretz Yisrael, he wrote about it after he moved to Rome. And his major purpose, in his writings, was to try to show the Romans that the Jewish system of law was a sophisticated and intelligent system of law. He was I'm sure you all know, Josephus was plain and simply a traitor who left the Jewish side and went to the Roman side during the war here in Israel. Just before the year 70 and through the year 70, but then he went back to Rome. And when he was in Rome, his patron supported him. His patron called Flavius. That's why he's called Josephus Flavius. You know, you're owned by the funding. If you're a scholar and you are funded by some person or by some agency, you're owned by that agency. So he was, in a certain sense, owned by Flavius.
And so
people always wonder about when Josephus writes about the law, and then you look at it and you say, gee, the Jewish law, the way Josephus describes it, looks just like the Roman law. It might be because Josephus is trying to tell the Romans that the Jews developed a system that is very similar to the system of law that was developed by the Romans. I had mentioned before. 4 that there are there's this extremely long discussion in the Gemara and Bava Kamma that to try to prove that ayin tachad ayin has to mean monetary penalty. And I had thought in the beginning that I wouldn't go into any detail, so I won't go into much detail about it, but just to see how that Talmudic sugya, how that Talmudic section is structured. It goes on rabbi after rabbi. Tanya Rabbi Dostai ben Yehuda Omer Ayin Tachad Ayin Mamon, and then Rabbi Dostai ben Yehuda offers his proof why Ayin Tachad Ayin, an eye for an eye, has to mean money. And then another rabbi comes along, Tanya Ider, another bright Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai Omer Ayin Tachad Ayin Mamon. Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai provides his proof why Ayin Tachad Ayin has to mean money. And then Zevei Rabbi Yishmael Tana, and then the scholars in the from the school of Rabbi Yishmael also offered their proof that Ayin Tachad Ayin has to mean money. And then Zevei Rabbi Chia Tana, and then from the school of Rabbi Chia, they offered their proofs. Tana Zevei Chizkia, and from the school of Chizkia, they offered their proofs. So it's a long discussion. They were offering various proofs with everybody trying to prove the same thing, that Ayin Tachad Ayin has to be money. But then, as I was preparing this class, I noticed that some scholars have suggested that there's a little hint in rabbinic literature that the rabbis were still arguing about this back in the first and the second century, that it wasn't a slam dunk. But so far, this looks like a slam dunk. Everybody's saying here, Dostai ben Yehuda, Shimon ben Yochai, Rabbi Shmuel, Rabbi Chiya, Chizkia, all of them are saying this. But then the next line of the text says, and here I give you the translation into English also, Tanya, Rabbi Eliezer, Omer, Ayin Tachad Ayin Mamash. Rabbi Eliezer taught that an eye for an eye is literal. And that's the extent of the quotation from Rabbi Eliezer in the Talmud. And so some scholars argued that Rabbi Eliezer was trying to promote the idea that it's a literal. The Gemara will have none of it. As you see the continuation of the Talmud, of the discussion here in the Gemara. Mamash Salka Daya? Could he literally mean literal? Is that possible that he thinks that Ayin Tachad Ayin is literal? Rabbi Eliezer, late like a whole Hami Tanai, he disagrees with that whole list of Tanaim there. You know, they all had different arguments, but they all were at the same, they had all come to the same conclusion that Ayin Tachad Ayin has to be money. Is it really possible that Rabbi Eliezer took this literally? And then the Gemara offers really a creative understanding of what it meant when Rabbi Eliezer said that Ayin Tachad Ayin is mamash, is literal, Ravashi,
or many generations after
Rabbi Eliezer. So it's not as if
Ravashi talked with Rabbi Eliezer
and is reporting what he heard from Rabbi Eliezer, but Ravashi said that what Rabbi Eliezer meant was that we estimate the value of the offender's limb and not the value of the victim's limb. What is halacha? Halacha is when you pay, when ayin tachad ayin means mamon, we saw a couple of weeks ago, the understanding is that if you look at a person who is being sold as a slave and see the difference in the value of the slave if he has two arms or one arm. If you chopped off the arm of another human being, then you see the value of a slave in the theoretical value of a slave in the marketplace with two arms or with one arm. And Ravashi said, and what Rabbi Eliezer said was that the perpetrator should understand that he deserves to lose his arm. So we go to the marketplace of slaves, and we have the perpetrator stand there and say, how much would you pay for this perpetrator to be your slave if he has two arms? And how much would you pay for the perpetrator to be your slave if he has only one arm? And the standard understanding is that you look at the victim. You look to see whether how much the victim would fetch now
as a slave,
now that he has one arm, compared to. And so this is, as I said, it's a very creative way of understanding
that how Rabbi
Eliezer could have said
an eye for an eye is
literal. He didn't literally mean, literally just meant that when you're looking, what is the perpetrator paying for? The perpetrator is paying the value of the perpetrator's arm and not the value of the arm of the victim, because the perpetrator deserves to lose this arm. And so what is the amount that the perpetrator deserves to lose? We can figure that out
by going to the marketplace for slaves
and seeing what
price
is fetched for a slave. What price is fetched for that perpetrator as a slave with two arms, as opposed to the price
that would be that
he would get if he had only one arm. And of course, you can buy in antiquity, you could buy a slave to do just about anything around your house. So if you're buying
a slave because you want the slave to rake
leaves on your lawn, then
having one arm certainly lowers the value of the slave.
But if you're
buying a slave, let's say, to teach Zoom classes, then it really
doesn't make a lot of difference whether the slave has one arm or two arms. So there might not
be such a big difference
between
the two prices. Okay, I'm going to stop here and take a look at the chat and see what we have, what has showed up there. Okay. Did the Rambam need to explain this in order to differentiate from what the law was in Islam? Susanna asked. That's distinctly possible. I actually never thought of that. But because there's the chopping off of hands, as we know in various Islamic societies, perhaps that's why Rambam went into so much detail here. Do we have any evidence that the literal version of eye for an eye was tried and proved unworkable
either in Israel or elsewhere? No, we don't have any evidence like that. But it's interesting speculation to think that there might have been a period of history in some society. Rambam said it never was in our society, but it might have been a period in some society. We know that it was tried in Rome, and maybe after a while, people gave it up. Please confirm the spelling alatorah.org. Yes, that is the spelling, alhatorah.org. Shira Rachel answered. Thank you, Shira Rachel.
Does Rambam not believe the about-to-die
man forgiving the other man, or are we worried that the other man may have paid the dying man off? I think that Rambam is, it's a great question, but I think that Rambam is saying that it isn't a crime against that person. It's a crime against God and society. And, a human being is in the divine image. And so it's like a crime against God. There's less of the divine image in the world if you kill another human being. And so the person who is about to die does not have the right to say, I don't mind the fact that I'm about to die. Please forgive the person. I think that that's what he's saying, that he doesn't have the right to forgive. We talked about this before, that in the Code of Hammurabi, it says that when there is a when there's a case of adultery of a married woman with somebody who is not her husband, that the husband has the right to forgive his wife if he wishes, and if he forgives his wife, then the king has the right to forgive the adulterer. And so this is not something that you would find in a Jewish law code, because because adultery is not considered a crime against the spouse. Adultery is considered a crime against God, as Yosef says to Potiphar's wife, how can I do such a terrible thing and sin against God? It doesn't say it's sin against your husband, but it's not. He interprets the adultery as a crime against God.
Somebody suggested to me privately that I was Lachlan Ontariokas when I studied Latin, and someone else said Miss Collip would be proud of me. That was her Latin teacher at chat.
Okay, Susanna says back to the content here. So the perp pays the coffer for his own limb, but perhaps the injured man's arm is worth more. True, it is a problem, but you know, all the Rav Ashi was trying to do was to come up with some kind of interpretation of what Rabbi Eliezer said that would not have Rabbi Eliezer suggesting the loss of a real limb. But you're right, the injured man's arm, and
we saw 2 weeks ago, we saw even Ezra talking about that
as a reason why the law of talion doesn't work very well, because one person's eye may be worth more than another person's eye. You know, depending on what the person does for a living, and one person's arm may be worth more than another person's arm. So it doesn't make sense to say that an eye for an eye or an arm for an arm, literally. Okay, next week we will have one more session on these kinds of laws. And as you heard, that starting 2 weeks from now, when it's Elul, we will be skipping over to the parts of Parshat Mishpatim that deal with strangers, widows, and orphans. And we may have some new people joining us. I'll try to make it a bit of a continuity for those of you who will continue from the summer session to the annual session, and still have something new for the people who join us in Elul.
Marty, before you go, your microphone still has, depending where you sit, at least it's clearer, but wherever you, sometimes it's great, but at least it's always clearer now. Like, you have different voices, but we can mostly understand no matter where you are.
Good. Thank you for the feedback. I appreciate it. Okay. Wonderful seeing you.
Thank you, everybody, for coming, and take a look out for our Elul series. And we'll see everybody next week.
Great. Bye-bye.